This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker has been adamant about the innocence of Kevin Strickland. He's been in prison for more than 42 years for a triple homicide. Gene Peters Baker says Kevin Strickland should be set free. Missouri Governor Mike Parson has refused to pardon Strickland. He's not convinced of his innocence. But a new law he just signed gives county prosecutors the power to vacate previous verdicts. Gene Peters Baker joins us now to talk about Kevin Strickland, a new county jail, and the prosecution of drug-related offenses. Gene, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Good morning.
You know, there's a lot of moving parts in this Kevin Strickland case. A judge in DeKalb County has set set hearing dates on this case next month that could result in his release. Also, the governor just signed this new law that I just mentioned that will impact what you can do. Let's talk about this. First, what's happening over in DeKalb County?
So I'm not a party to that action, but of course I'm watching it closely,
sure.
And I did file a supportive brief in that matter as well. I believe there was a hearing on Friday, and I believe that the can got kicked even further down the road on the DeKalb County case. So it does apply a little bit more timing pressure, I believe, on my ability to go forward with a hearing before a judge. At some point of the effective date, August 28th.
But why is DeKalb County even involved here?
That is currently the county of residence for Kevin Strickland because that is where he is incarcerated.
You know, the Office of Attorney General Eric Schmidt says in court filings that Kevin Strickland has spent 40 years working to evade responsibility. You say he's innocent. You've apologized to him. How can there be such sharp disagreements on a case like this?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. So to try and pull it out of that posture that it's very unfortunately been put in my estimation, that's very, very unfortunate. My office did a review, a thorough review. Now, we do this on a lot of cases. And, you know, not to surprise you, there are cases that people have brought to me that said, this person's innocent, Gene, look at it, free him. And I have disagreed. So this happens too. Just because you come to me doesn't mean, you know, that the review is going to result in your freedom. But there are cases like Kevin Strickland's where it is, in my estimation, in my professional judgment, and in the judgment of those who reviewed this case with me, a clear case of actual innocence. And so that is why we're moving forward on Kevin Strickland, and for that reason only.
I mentioned this bill that Governor Parson has signed that would allow you to take steps to free people like Kevin Strickland. What does the bill allow you to do, and when does it go into effect?
All right. August 28th is the effective date. That happens to be a Saturday. So, unfortunately, we will not be having a hearing on a Saturday.
Yeah.
But it does allow me to file my motion with a judge in Jackson County. And that judge will then hear the evidence that's presented and make a finding. So it just gives me a legal pathway on someone that I believe has an actual innocence claim that's short of DNA. Like DNA is not a factor in this case. And that's, you know, the truth in a lot of cases. DNA is not, you know, sort of the holy grail. In this case, it was our evaluation of a recantation. The whole totality of the case, the totality of that recantation, the credibility behind that recantation, that's what's landed me here and why I'm willing to fight for this, as I will fight for convictions to remain
sure.
in place. I will also fight for justice, however that is the right path to take. In this case, justice means Kevin Strickland should not continue to be held, in my estimation. In my professional judgment and in the professional judgment of this team that I put together in my office. So we will see very soon what a Jackson County judge says.
And if the Jackson County judge says Kevin Strickland should be freed, will he be freed? Is that how this works?
Yes, I believe that is how it works.
So
that's
how it works. So this new law basically gives you a route outside of the governor's office for a path forward here then.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and it's potentially a game changer for Kevin Strickland.
I believe, look, my job is sometimes I get cast, you know, as a villain in a lot of different places. It's sometimes, you know, I don't embrace that that role that people want to give me to be their villain. In this case, I worked very hard to review this case really as a professional. You know, I've been a prosecutor well over 20 years now, and I know how to evaluate evidence. I'm not good at all things, but I'm good at some things. And I know how to put together the right team as well to look at these old cases so that we don't have sort of that reflexive review of an old case that we're never going to see innocence even when it's before us. But we're also able to disagree with people, you know, when we don't see it, when we think maybe it's just too unclear. Kevin Strickland's case is one truly where I don't know. There's room for argument, perhaps, but I don't know how you could come to the conclusion that he's not, that he committed these crimes. Mm-hmm. I think you could come to the conclusion that you maybe didn't like young Kevin Strickland. You didn't like all the things that he said to the police. You didn't like everything about him. But that does not equate into a conviction of a triple homicide that he just didn't do.
You know, when you talked about this at your news conference a few weeks back, you became emotional, I think. This is obviously a case that you feel very strongly about.
Yeah, I do feel strongly about it. And I feel really mortified as well when the criminal justice system makes such a grave error like this. And so I want it to be corrected. I want injustices to be corrected. So when I see cases that go unsolved, you know, that's a burden as well. I want that horrible thing that happens in our community when a murder happens, someone's life is taken. I always want there to be some measure, the right measure of justice for that. In this case, I think we've done harm. Maybe that no one intended to, there's not a malice here, but it happened. A wrong happened. And so I want to right it.
If Kevin Strickland is eventually released, Jean, what type of compensation from the state is he going to receive?
None. He will receive no compensation.
Zero.
There is no mechanism that I am aware of that he can receive compensation presently.
If he is released, then what kind of support will be given to him? He'll have no money coming out of prison.
Right.
What's the path forward for a man who has spent 42 years of his life in prison coming out like that?
So Kevin Strickland marks, you know, he is so similar to others that walk out prison doors, even if your stay had been a lot shorter than 42, 43 years. We could do such a better job at setting people up for success when they get out. So the deal that a prosecutor often makes with a criminal defendant is that you're going to go do your time. It's what's required, you know, to sort of right a wrong as best the system knows how to do it. But we literally open the doors and shove them out the door, and that's it. You know, they rarely even have the right kind of ID, though we may have had possession of them, their body, and everything about them over the amount of time that they've done. They step out into the world with not even the ability to get correct identification in order to comply with all of the conditions that we set on them. So we put a lot of barriers on their path. And we really, if we recognized that the vast majority of people that go into prison are coming back out, that is the deal that struck at the time. If we looked at that day and did some preparation short of the day when the doors swing open, mm-hmm. and you're free to go, we could have a much better success rate, and we could have a lot better public safety if we prepared people for that eventual day when they will be released.
You know, Kansas has a relatively new law that compensates victims who are wrongly imprisoned. Why doesn't Missouri?
You know, there's some things I can't answer.
Yeah. Right?
And I don't have an answer for that.
You support something like that, though?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course.
Is it possible that the guilt or innocence of a man like Kevin Strickland, maybe just a final point, is now tied to the partisan warfare going on in this country? I mean, is that where we are with a case like this?
I think
Republicans have to say he's guilty because the tough on crime thing and the attitude on the other side might be a little different.
That is, I shouldn't be surprised, I suppose, but I was very surprised to receive, you know, the flood of subpoenas that came to my office from the Attorney General, the posture that was taken by the Attorney General on this case, because I really did review it as a professional. And there are cases, again, the same lawyers that are working on Kevin Strickland's release, we will disagree on other individuals. I will guarantee it. That's my job, though. My job is to evaluate evidence and take it for what it is, and seek to right a wrong if there is one, right? But also seek to support convictions when I should.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was disheartening, really disheartening to read that motion that was filed and all the supporting
right
subpoenas that came with it. I really I supported the bill that the governor just signed, and I was one of the few people in the room that supported the Attorney General's right to intervene in like a Kevin Strickland case should this bill pass. And a lot of people said, no, we do not want to give this Attorney General this kind of power. And I pushed back on everyone, people across all political spectrums, by the way, too, mm-hmm. had that opinion. And I pushed back because I believe you do not set public policy based on present office holders. We don't do that. And so we'll just work through it and the right thing will happen. So it is right for an attorney general to come into those cases and sort of add, you know, make sure that I got it right,
mm-hmm.
Make sure that I didn't miss something. But the fact that maybe someone in my office spoke to a member of the Star about this case, and who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Who cares? I mean, I had a public press conference, mm-hmm. and reporters actually came in. And so I have done some interviews, and none of that has anything to do with Kevin Strickland's innocence or his guilt. So I would just beg the other professionals, you know, at some point in a courtroom on Kevin Strickland, that we keep our eye on that prize. And the great thing about being in a courtroom is that politics can't survive there, because you got a judge that generally, you know, shuts that off.
Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker is my guest. Let's turn to a different topic, Gene. You recently wrote a letter to the Board of Police Commissioners here in Kansas City, in which you called on police to stop sending over hundreds of cases involving low-level drug crimes. You want the focus to be more on violent crime. Why did you feel compelled to write that letter and then release it?
Boy, that's Kansas City. Steve is in a real crisis, and we say that a lot, and it maybe loses some of its import because maybe that word gets used too often. You know, we're experiencing this terrible pandemic, and just when we think we've kind of turned the corner, we realize we haven't. We're not close to turning the corner on crime.
Mm-hmm.
And there are particular communities, I would call them, you know, communities that are very vulnerable and that have been harmed by policing strategies, prosecution strategies. I don't want to lay all this at police feet because it's been at mine, too. But when you learn more, like what we learned through that data, which was thousands and thousands of cases that we pulled to mine data to come to these conclusions, you can't ignore it. The racial disparities that are imbued in that data must be addressed. Take the racial disparities out. There's an incredible ineffectiveness and incredible cost to us enforcing, continuing to force this war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So Jackson County has another answer. Some communities don't, like my the two Northland prosecutors spoke about. They sent a letter as well. But what the Northland doesn't have, what Jackson County does have, is that we have this combat tax, a quarter cent sales tax. It's what started drug court over 30 years ago,
right.
Led by a prosecutor as well. And I now, of course, there are drug courts in the Northland. You know, it's become normalized. It's what we do. Over 30 years ago, Steve, it was not embraced. It was radical. It was ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, what are we coddling these criminals? And I laugh about that now because now every county in the state of Missouri has a drug court. I think there's one county that doesn't have their own, but they utilize a neighboring county. So the point I'm making is we should continue to be innovative here, and we should look at how we are enforcing. How and where are we enforcing? And is that unfair?
Mm-hmm.
Is that unfair? We don't want our policing practices and our prosecution practices to be unfair. And that's what I'm really trying to draw us to look at. This I want to really, really try and make this point. It once was, you know, the West versus the East was often pitted against each other here. Now it appears it's sort of shifted and it's North versus South.
This is West side versus East side of Kansas City,
correct.
North versus South. Yeah, south of the river.
Correct.
Right.
And what I would tell you is that, you know, policing strategies where I live on the West side are not what they are on the East side. I don't even know what they are in the Northland because that's not my jurisdiction. But I would be shocked if, you know, the kind of enforcement strategies I see on the East side in these very vulnerable communities is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I look at that, when you look at the map, the overlay of map of where our violent crime occurs, it happens to be where all these heavy law enforcement practices have been. In defense of police, they have done that because it had been the best practice. Saturation patrols, be tough, you know, make sure you ticket everybody for every small infraction.
And your
occurs.
Point is that's resulted in this incredible racial disparity in terms of who's getting charged with drug crimes in Kansas City.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Hey,
and the numbers bear that out. That's not my opinion. The one that one little piece that really ticked me off was when there was a reference that my feelings for a particular law led this discovery. You know, okay, please.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of cases led me to that discovery.
One of your other points here and some of the data that your office has come up with shows that just the number of prosecution attempts for drug-related crimes far outweighs the number of crimes being charged for violent crime. There's a massive disparity there. Tell me about that.
That... When you really start digging into data, you start learning more about, you know, overall practices.
Right.
So what I learned is from pulling all of these cases, and really this was pandemic driven, by the way, my jump into this data was because I formed a crime strategies unit, you know, at the end of 2019. And then we really start, you know, trying to figure out how can we be more effective? How can we keep people safer? What practices can we do? So that was our mission and our focus. Then the pandemic hit and we were, you know, kind of shut out of courtrooms for a lot of cases. So I needed to really hone in on my resources. And so I looked at drugs to see, you know, what's the number that are coming in the door. Those were coming in by the buckets full.
Mm-hmm.
When violence is so too rarely comes in my door, too rarely comes in my door. So... Why are we so poor,
mm-hmm.
you know, in solving violence, but we are so tough on drug crimes? It didn't make a lot of sense, except there is this philosophy. And if you're a member of law enforcement, like I am, you were taught that drugs equal violence. That's the way it is. Now, the public, by the way, doesn't believe that. By the way, my juries don't believe that because this is not just police data that I'm looking at. It's my own data.
Right.
And my data was showing me, wow, my juries have let me know quit this. Quit bringing us these cases.
And so your message to police then has been what? What are you saying to them about what you want them to do when it comes to drug cases?
So I want drug cases. I still want them with this caveat. I want the nexus to violence. Bring me the individual that the police can demonstrate to me has a nexus to violence. I didn't think that was probably quite enough as well, so I left another category. Someone with a high community concern, meaning someone comes in on a block, they start selling drugs, they set up on that block, and then all of a sudden overnight, yeah, that block becomes very unstable. I want that case as well. So this is not what will be said, I'm sure, because this is the easy political line to take. Baker ain't prosecuting drug cases anymore. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to prosecute drug cases where there is a nexus to violence because, Steve, that will lead to better public safety. Right now, I'm getting buckets full and buckets full of cases where there is no tie to violence. I know that because I mined all my own data, and only about 25% of those drug cases showed an actual link to violence.
Mm-hmm.
That surprised me. As a law enforcement person who was taught drugs equal violence, you know, the poor people that do data for me in the office, I had to go back multiple times because I challenged them repeatedly.
Right.
That can't be right. You missed something. So we even broadened the definition of what violence was so that I could kind of see how much more we could capture.
But what was the reaction of the police board when you approached them about with your idea here? What kind of response have you gotten from the department?
Well, you know, not surprising, everybody in law enforcement that I first approach, including people in my own office, you know, when I presented this data to them, there's such a skepticism because you just know it must be wrong. It's got to be wrong. Drugs equal violence. We all know that. We're taught that. It's just simply not true. So I had to keep showing them the data. They gave me a lot more suggestions about what other data I should mine and look at. We did those things. And finally, people start coming along. But you don't get this. Law enforcement won't get this generally on the first pass. There's a reactionary, that reflexive reaction, which is, that can't be right.
Yeah. So they are still continuing to send you the same volume of drug cases you've had in the past?
Yeah, they are. My hope was after sitting down with police commanders, you know, and everyone that sort of was over those drug units, that we could come to a better conclusion. I do believe that we got there. And then it just maybe it's coincidental, but all of those folks were removed from their positions and moved to different parts of the police department in sort of that the police do this every so often. But everybody that had sort of reviewed the data, challenged the data, and kind of came back to the table with their own suggestions about how to implement this new policy. We're calling it a public safety policy because I think that's the most accurate terminology for it. They were moved. So unfortunately, you know, I have to kind of start over again.
Can you put a human face on what you're talking about? Give me an example of a case that is the kind of case that you don't think is worth pursuing as vigorously as perhaps some other violent crime cases.
Sure. I have scores of those examples. Here's one. You are a passenger in a car. The car gets pulled over for whatever traffic violation occurred. And there becomes a search of car, and then your backpack, as the passenger, your backpack is in the car, and what is found in your backpack is a pill, and you don't have a prescription for that pill. And that's a felony. That's a state level felony. Now that's brought to my office.
Wow.
And while that case is occurring, we've had homicides that occur, and we've had scores of shootings occur, bullets that actually strike people. They go to the hospital, their wounds are sewn up, and that case is not solved. So, and they happen in the same place. So if this strategy of going after these vulnerable neighborhoods where most of the crime occurs, most of the violent crime occurs, if that strategy is not working, we should look at it. Has it actually harmed us? Has it actually harmed public safety? Does it make the same people that get, you know, a felony conviction Or maybe they get sent to drug court. You know, maybe they do, maybe they don't. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be very reluctant to help police solve that next crime that occurs on their block? Did they see anything? And they just decide they don't want to help because they don't trust the criminal justice system has their best interests at heart, nor the best interest of their community at heart.
Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters-Baker is my guest. We have her for a few more minutes. Our number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jean, on a related manner, the governor has signed a bill creating something called the Second Amendment Preservation Act. He says it's an attempt to reject any attempt by the federal government to circumvent the fundamental right Missourians have to keep and bear arms to protect themselves and their property. What's your opinion of this new act?
When I first saw it, I thought, okay, what to give credibility to it, I always start there. What problem was the legislature trying to solve? What's the problem? I think their fear is a prospective fear that there's going to be some limitation on guns. There's going to be some new kind of regulations going to come in at the federal level. And then this, and I don't necessarily see that happening. but either way, it seems to be a problem we're trying to solve that isn't here. And it seems very political to me. So, you know, I have so much bandwidth, only so much bandwidth. This is so political to me that I think I'll leave that to others to jump in and take care of. I would ask, if law enforcement is listening, this needs to be your fight. You need to start testifying against these kinds of bills, mm-hmm. not just sit in the background, not just offer up. Small, little, not controversial opinions. If you believe you are injured by these types of bills, you need to start talking. It is not me. I'm not doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm not there. I'm not doing it. So law enforcement is really harmed by these bills. And they're really very, very political in nature.
Couple other quick topics here. Let's turn to the new jail. The Jackson County Legislature just voted to spend about $7 million on a site for a new county jail. This is a 107-acre property out on 40 Highway that's currently the Hart Mobile Village Trailer Park. So it sounds like the new jail is going to become a reality, Gene. Is that where we are with this right now?
I think that's true. I served on a steering committee for the county where we tried to look at all the issues that were attendant to the possibility of a new jail. And it was a group that really had the best interest in mind of the county and what does the county need to do. Our jail, which I want to give credit here, Sheriff Forte is now over that jail, and it's the same building with the same physical problems that it always had. It is a difficult building, mm-hmm. I think, for anyone to manage. But they are managing so much better than so many other communities are able to manage an overcrowded jail with a really failing infrastructure. So credit where credit is due. That has been turned around. However, we do need a new jail. We need a jail that that is safe, that is more humane, and gives a little bit more flexibility for all parties involved.
That means a radically different design, ultimately.
It
here.
It does.
Well, what happens to the old jail, the old building? What's the future of that building?
Probably a wrecking ball. And you start, wow. that property becomes available. I hope for purchase by someone else, and it's if the jail is moving to a different location, hopefully that is not real estate the county has to always continue to own forever and ever.
That's Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters-Baker. Gene, always appreciate you coming in and sharing your views. Always a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Steve.